This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, April 13th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. Harm reduction encompasses far more than just opioids. Physicians practice it all the time. Many lifestyle choices that many of us don't want to give up contribute to disease that we also don't want. Harm reduction is the process of mitigating the costs of those choices. But with opioids, it's often federal and state law that stand in the way of harm reduction. Cato's Jeff Singer discusses how physicians think about it.
One of the people who spoke at your recent harm reduction conference was Ed Rendell.
Yes.
Of Pennsylvania, the former governor of Pennsylvania. And you note in an article recently that he has come around in a way on the notion of harm reduction with respect to drug overdoses that the United States is dealing with in a, or should say a significant issue that the United States is dealing with right now. How do doctors look at harm reduction in a very general way?
Well, it's interesting. When I speak with my colleagues about the harm reduction approach to dealing with the drug abuse problem, most of them immediately get it, even if they hadn't heard about the concept, if that's not their area of expertise. When I explain it to them, they immediately are on board, because when you think about it, in modern medicine, in a developed country like the United States, much of what we do every day is practice harm reduction. Back in the early part of the 20th century, most people were concerned about dying from infectious diseases, days before antibiotics, or trauma related to job-related trauma. But in the modern developed countries like the U.S. and most of the Western countries, we pretty much eradicated the terrible infectious diseases. Sanitation is better. It's technology has made it so that it's much less likely to get a job-related injury. So now, a lot of what we doctors do every day in our practice of medicine is in effect harm reduction. So, for example, you get a person who's overweight and eats poorly, and as a result of their poor eating habits, they have high cholesterol and high blood pressure. And of course, this puts them at risk for all sorts of problems like heart attacks, strokes, et cetera. And in many cases, the doctor knows that you can get that patient down to having no cholesterol problem or no blood pressure problem just by getting that patient to follow a strict dietary regimen, maybe exercise diet. But you're also realistic. You have a patient who you just know they're not going to be able to adhere to this. They don't want to adhere to it. They like to eat. They like to watch TV and stuff potato chips in their mouth rather than go to the gym. So you say, okay, well, let me put you on a blood pressure medicine and a statin drug for your cholesterol so I could decrease the chances of your behavioral choices giving you a stroke or a heart attack. That's harm reduction. Or when you have your primary care provider and you have a patient who tells you that he or she engages in unsafe sex, and you encourage them to use condoms to decrease the risk of spreading sexually transmitted disease, that's harm reduction. Or a lot of early diabetics can be controlled also with diet, but they can't do it. So you put them on a drug like metformin to bring their diabetes under control. So a lot of what we do every day is practicing harm reduction. So when you mention to a healthcare practitioner, when you have a person using intravenous drugs recreationally, where they're at risk of getting overdoses or diseases from sharing dirty needles, and you say, what about the idea of having facilities where they could inject in the presence of healthcare practitioners with clean needles and syringes, and there's somebody standing by to save their life if they have an overdose, so you're reducing the risk of overdose or disease. Most doctors just immediately, when you explain that to them, they say, sure, that makes sense. It just kind of fits with everything else we do. Well, Governor Rendell, of course, it's in the news. He's part of a group of volunteers, a nonprofit group, trying to get a safe injection facility in Philadelphia. It's been given the green light by the City Council of Philadelphia. Is completely privately financed, but the federal government is trying to prevent him from doing that. So, but when Governor Rendell spoke here at Cato a short while ago, it was clear to me from the way he spoke that he gets harm reduction. And I was, as a doctor, I was gratified to see that.
Now, with respect to, you know, some of the people that I spoke with who were speakers at your conference were making the point that, one, many people don't ever inject themselves.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That there are people who go their whole lives either dependent on or addicted to opiates of some kind, have never injected themselves. And still more people don't know what safe injection actually is or how to go about it.
That's it. Yeah, it's true. And that's, it was Darwin Fisher, I think, who was discussing that. He runs the safe injection facility in Vancouver, British Columbia. Some people, they have a friend inject them. For example, they just have problems knowing how to do it properly, and then they don't know how to safely do it on their own. And when they try to, they run into all sorts of problems.
And this is more pronounced for drugs, highly addictive chemicals than say food or the decision not to exercise. Because it's harm reduction for somebody to say, you know what, you probably just don't have the discipline to actually follow through on a lifestyle decision that would involve walking a few miles a day, eating a little less of this and eating a little more of that, and, you know, getting out of the house, getting some sun, that sort of thing. I think it's even more pronounced when you're talking about it in the context of an addictive chemical.
Oh, absolutely, because in most cases, the harm reduction we practice as doctors, these are choices people are making. Whereas people who are addicted, addiction is a compulsive behavioral disease, which is characterized by repeatedly doing the behavior despite negative consequences to health, to your life in general. These people have a compulsive disorder that compels them to engage in this, no matter how hard they want it to stop. And society is fine with a person who doesn't have that disorder and makes the conscious choice. No, I think I'm going to continue to eat high fat foods and gain weight and not go to the gym. And we say, okay, well, if you must do that, if you're not going to follow my advice, at least let me give you something to reduce your risks of harm. It's even more compelling when you have a person who can't control these, they basically don't have as much of a choice, control over their choice to engage in this activity without getting actual help.
So moving forward, what stands in the way? What are the obstacles facing cities or even states that would like to approve facilities for safe injection? Presumably just the fact that there are federally controlled drugs on a particular piece of property on a regular basis poses a problem.
Yeah, a lot of it is the federal law. There's some state laws that are in a way as well, but when it comes to safe injection facilities, they've been in existence since the 1980s. They're in over 120 major cities. Every country in the developed world, with the exception of the United States, has them: Australia, Canada, Europe. And in our country, it's federally against the law to permit the use of a federally banned substance on your premises. And so, it's not even like. These groups are asking for taxpayers to fund these things. For example, the group in Philadelphia has obtained completely private funding, and a donor donated a building. So if the federal government would just get out of the way, safe injection facilities can get underway in this country. But then there are other things. For example, methadone. Okay, methadone is a proven treatment for addiction. It's called medication-assisted treatment is the term that's been used. This is non-controversial. Even some of the more strident drug warriors are okay with methadone programs. But in this country, in order to have a methadone clinic to treat your patient's addiction with methadone, you have to go through all of these incredibly onerous regulations. It's enforced by the Drug Enforcement Administration. And among the rules is that the person has to come every day to the clinic, and in the presence of one of the staff members, either a nurse or a doctor, you have to watch them take the methadone, and then they leave. So, because, you know, since they have a drug addiction, I guess the idea is they can't be trusted. And then in some cases, over time, there are some instances where they're allowed to take some home when they've been good good, you know, following the rules for several months. Now, if you live in a rural area or in a city that just has one methadone clinic or something like that, that's not going to work. A person's not going to drive 100 miles every day to take their methadone in front of somebody. And also, when you have people who have a compulsive disorder, and oftentimes their life is in a state of chaos, to expect them to follow rules like this is unrealistic.
That's one of the things that from the other people that I spoke with from your harm reduction conference, it seems like the design of their facilities almost entirely surrounds the idea of essentially meeting drug users where they are. They they provide the ability for somebody to clean themselves, to access other benefits, to learn more about how to do what they're doing
it's
safely.
It's almost like a truck stop. You know, you can come in, you can shower, you can wash yourself. There's places where you can have conversations with people too. And that's another thing. A lot of these people, we're talking about the people who are on the street who are IV drug users. These people have been cut off. They're ostracized. They have an incredibly low sense of self-esteem, which makes it even more challenging to get them off of their problem. And now, all of a sudden, in addition to having a place where they could inject in safety, they have people who appear to actually want to connect to them and care about them, which, you know, conveys to them that, you know, you actually are worth something. You're worth something to me. I want to have a conversation with you. And that all kind of helps actually get them off their feet. And the experience with safe injection facilities worldwide has been that they've actually been a great a magnet to get people into actual rehab programs, because after a while, when these relationships develop, they're now more open to being directed into some rehab. So not only does it save lives, but it also helps get people treated for their addiction. Getting back to the methadone thing, it's ironic. In this country, under federal law, I'm a surgeon and I have a narcotics license, so I could prescribe opioids for my patients in pain. And methadone is a class two opioid. And I am legally allowed to prescribe methadone for pain. And in fact, it's not the commonly prescribed, but there are situations when you have a person who's in exquisite pain, oftentimes a terminal cancer patient, where we doctors will prescribe methadone. As long as I prescribe it for pain, that's fine. But if I prescribe it to someone who is going into withdrawal from, let's say, a heroin, and I'm prescribing it to help them deal with their withdrawal or to help them deal with their addiction, I can't do that without a special methadone Drug Enforcement Administration licensed methadone clinic. I could actually get in trouble if I don't do it that way. It's kind of ironic. Now, in many other countries, including the UK, Canada, Australia, France, doctors who are interested in treating this can prescribe methadone to patients in their office, just like they prescribe any other pain medication. And in fact, doctors now can prescribe another type of medication-assisted treatment, which is called buprenorphine or Suboxone. They have to take an eight-hour course to do it, but once they do that, they can prescribe that in the same setting. So here's another example of where we're not even talking about spending money. We're talking about just the government getting out of the way. If the government reformed its methadone law so that doctors who are interested in treating people with a substance abuse problem can just write a prescription for methadone and have them follow up in their office periodically, so many more people would get access to methadone treatment for their addiction than are able to get access now. And that's just simply a matter of getting out of the way.
Jeff Singer is a surgeon and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.